Okay, welcome to Discovery Bridge Lecture 4, which will also be a combination of Discovery 2 Chapter 1. So I think we'll call it Discovery 2 Lecture 1 when we get to naming it. Okay, has anybody, before I get started on the new material, has anybody got any questions on the previous material we've covered in the past 3 weeks or so?
No, it's really well covered last week, and the audio fills in for the bits I missed anyway, so it was good.
Well, it's always good to get some positive feedback. Your check's in the mail. okay, well, that's good. I mean, we don't have a lot of students on yet, so I'll be interested to see how many materializers we... Okay, well, that's... all right. Yeah, I just saw that. I've got text-to-speech announcements. I can hear who joins and leaves. Good old Lee just went, Leon has left the server. So I'm like, well, that's her, disappeared. All good. There was something I was going to say, and my train of thought's just derailed itself. Geraldine's running Vista. Did you tell everybody, Geraldine?
Yes, I'm running Vista.
what made you do that?
So far, so good. It's the operating system on the MiniNote.
You couldn't get it with XP? I know it's a rather...
No.
No.
Difficult. I think there's only an Asus, and then I think some of the IBM laptops that you can still get with XP, but you've got to roll it back.
Also, there are HP models that you can roll back to XP, and apparently there are rollback disks for the MiniNote, and in fact we can load XP on it. We do have the necessary credentials and keys to do that. But it came with Vista on it, and we decided to give it a go and see how it would go. It's very slow on the mini notes, which are via 1.6, so I'll probably be imaging up mine and sticking Windows XP Pro on mine over the weekend. That's assuming that Gemma gets enough good hours in the day to be able to kick the install through, so we'll take it as it comes, and we'll probably...
I'm going to give it a whirl.
Are you taking yours back to XP, Gemma?
As soon as I can.
Yeah, I thought so. I've got some links to some image software that we might be able to image up the old install, and then we can put the XP back on. We're looking for an accessible disk image program that works under Windows, and we'll image it up onto our multitude of external hard drives. Not fair. I mean, I could talk about this stuff all lecture, except it's CCNA today, not ITE, so let's move on. But let's just say the mini notes are cool. They've got a keyboard that's 92% of regular size. They weigh about 1.3 kilos. They've got a 120 gig hard drive in them. And they're a good bit of kit. I better open my chat window. Okay, now the first part of this is on troubleshooting. So I'm going to throw it open here. What's the first thing you should check when your network's got a problem?
Cables.
Yep. Probably before you... that's the overall answer, but before you check the cables, what's the thing you should check if you can before you even start looking at the cables?
Just do a quick check to make sure whether you've got an internet connection that you can do quite quickly.
The answer I was actually after, which isn't for all blind people, of course, is you should check the lights if you can see them.
Yeah, very funny.
This is not the point where I start singing songs like Blinded by the Light or anything like that. But anyway.
I might watch it.
It's an interesting story to that song, actually. But we'll move on. So you check your lights, you check your cabling, you check your connections. If you've got a wireless network, then you'd want to check that. One of the big things I'd be checking before you do too much more is that your wireless network is actually turned on. It's amazing how radios don't send and receive if they're turned off. And it is a requirement, I believe, of the 802.11 standards that you have the ability to be able to turn the wireless on and off, either through software or through hardware. And some notebooks have both options. For example, mine has software on-off control and it has a switch. And you'd be surprised how many people try and use wireless networking with the switch turned off.
And sometimes it could be a matter of mistyping your WEP or WPA keys.
Yes, and Gemma's laptop doesn't have a wireless switch. Yes, typing your keys will stop things from working. Now, I don't know whether everybody's seen, in a lot of wireless configuration dialogues, there's a thing that says type of authentication, and you can either have open, shared, or 802 point, whatever it is, that other one that I can never remember, 802.1x. Now, open means that you can associate with the access point no matter who you are, but if you set it to shared, you can't even associate with the access point unless you provide the correct WEP or WPA key. And if you're going to set it to shared, you've got to make sure that you get the keys correct on both sides and on all devices, because putting in an incorrect WEP key will prevent your machine from being able to exchange packets with the access point. Okay, so what the notes are saying here, they're saying ping your default gateway from your wired wired or wireless network and see whether it's going to work. Now, if you ping it from the wired network and it works, and you ping it from the wireless network and it doesn't, then you've got a problem with wireless. Good morning, Eddie.
Good morning.
And how are you today?
I'm good.
What's what we... Ah, here we are. And you're back, are you, Leone?
I am, Kerry, yes.
I had a question for you earlier, but you managed to evaporate before I could ask you. Did you manage to drag down the last week's lecture on wireless networks, or is that on your to-do list? Because everybody enjoyed that one.
That's still on my to-do list, Kerry.
No, that's okay. It's under the discovery section, under the audio section. So, yeah, I just figured that because you're probably in the market for setting up your wireless network soon, it might be a good lecture to drag down. Alrighty. So, if you ping it from the wired and you ping it from the wireless and it works from the wired and it doesn't work from the wireless, then you've got a problem with your wireless setup. If it works from the wireless and doesn't work from the wired, then you might have a problem with your cable setup. All pretty straightforward. If it doesn't work from both, get a hammer and get yourself a new router. No, just kidding. Then you've got to check other things out. Also, make sure that when you install your router that you've just bought, because it's a really cool one, and you went and turned the firewall access on to high, what usually happens when you turn the firewall on, as I think Dean found out in the very early days of having his billion, is certain things stop working depending on what security level you've got it turned on. Was it you who found that out, Dean, or am I falsely accusing you?
No, you actually are falsely accusing her. No, that was a software issue I had with Norton's. I think that was the other American gentleman that I can't vaguely remember his name.
Yeah, that's okay. No, I wasn't sure whether you had the billion firewall turned on at one point. No, it wasn't you. It was another one of my friends. So, yes, I apologise. We won't falsely accuse Dean of that one.
Moving right along.
Yes, we'll go on. There was another person I knew who actually turned on his firewall and then wondered why pings were being blocked and why he couldn't do all sorts of different things. Now, one of the things that you first learn about setting up networks is that you turn all of the firewalls and things off while you are doing all the initial testing, and you add in the security things one by one. And the reason you do that is because all sorts of things will not work if you've got firewalls turned on and that sort of thing. Somebody who will remain nameless spent 3 weeks trying to get their file and printer sharing working and tried to connect to files on from one computer to the other, and actually had a third-party firewall installed on their computer without them knowing. And that was actually blocking the connections, so check the simple things first.
That's a common one, that one.
Oh, yeah. And things like zone alarm and stuff can really get in the way unless they're configured properly. And that's one of the problems with these personal firewalls. A lot of people don't know how to configure personal firewalls properly, and they end up locking themselves out of things that I'd actually like to do. Okay, the other thing you should probably check on your router is you should check your power light, if you can see them. And we do have a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, who we will all know, who does make some very good light probes. and does make them fairly cheaply. So if this person ever gets around to making some more of them, we'll let you know. But it is actually possible for us to check the state of various lights on devices if we can get our hands on one of these light probes.
So what that picks up, that there's a light source, Kerry, is that correct?
Yeah, it's got a little box that's got the batteries and the buzzer and stuff in it. Then it's on the end of an RCA lead. He's got the photodiode, and depending on the strength and colour of the light, it changes the pitch of the whistling that comes out of the box. So you can tell whether lights are blinking or stuff.
That's a fantastic idea.
Unfortunately, what he usually mounts the photodiodes in is a marker pen, like the body of a marker pen. But he says that he hasn't actually had any dead marker pens because he keeps on unblocking them by putting a small amount of methyl ethyl ketone down the top of them to actually unblock them, and they just keep running and running and running. I said we'd just buy him the felt pens and he could just have the outsides of them, but... his desire to get these felt pens running again overrode his desire to build the light probes.
Okay.
So if you do have a blocked up felt pen and you're sure there's lots and lots of ink left in it and you paid good money for that pen, you want some methyl ethyl ketone, which is plumber's primer from Bunnings, and just a little bit of that in the tube thing, and away it'll go, and it'll write for many more weeks to come. And that little hint comes to you from the Iron Things Just Don't Last As Long As They Used To department. So, and moving on. Okay, we're checking the lights. Also checking the cables. Are you using a straight through or a crossover cable? Some devices are very fussy as to which cable you are using. Crossover cables are used for linking similar devices together, for example PC to PC, hub to hub, switch to switch. And straight through cables are used for linking PC to switch, PC to hub, etc. Most modern network devices will automatically flick the pairs over to the right way, which is called Auto MDIX, I think they call it. There we go, I've started everybody yawning now. You can actually... but a lot of the older Cisco gear is very fussy with the cables it'll use, and you do need to know whether you're using a crossover or a straight through. And if you put the wrong cable on, it won't work. How do you tell the difference between a crossover and a straight through? You either look at the ends, or you have a colour standard... as in the green ones are the straight through and the blue ones are the crossover, until somebody crimps a blue straight through, which finishes you off, but you've got to make sure that doesn't happen. Or you stick a label on them. And we did find a way of getting some plastic tags with little wire ties on them, and then you could stick like a Braille Dymo label on the tag, and that would be how you could identify the cables. Okay, check your cable lengths. Are you trying to run 150 metres of Cat 5? She'll be right, mate, that shouldn't be a problem. Well, it might be. So do check your cable lengths and make sure they're correctly terminated. Make sure the person that has crimped them for you has actually crimped them properly and hasn't left 5 mils between the connector and the insulation. You actually want to crimp the connector onto the insulation to actually relieve the strain from the actual cables themselves.
And make sure no one mouses or chewed the cables either.
Exactly. If you happen to have lots of mice, you need to make sure that the mice, or in fact the pet rabbit, hasn't chewed through your cables. Oh, there we go. Okay. And that is certainly a big problem if you do have rodents and mice or rabbits and things. What I want to know is, why is it always the network cables they chew through? If they chew through the 240 volt power cable, that should be the end of the offending animal. But it's always the network cable they get, and unfortunately that doesn't finish them off.
Yeah, it's always the longest one as well.
And they chew through it in the bit that is the hardest to get to, the one that like took you like 10 minutes to get through that particularly nasty piece of like underfloor space.
Yeah, no, we had one that's going around to the kids' bedrooms and they chewed through the two longest ones.
Exactly. And funnily enough, chopping off the chewed bits and then splicing it back together doesn't always work too well. It can, but it's not the easiest thing to do. Although, I suppose what you could do is you could chop out the chewed bit and then you could put two RJ45 connectors on where you chop the ends off, and then you could get one of those joiners and join it back together that way. Which is an interesting point. If you're going to run cable, It's worth running an extra 4 or 5 meters and storing it either in the ceiling space or whatever, so that you're not just running the bare minimum length of cable. Okay, troubleshooting wireless networks. One of the big things that can happen, as I said, is your wireless could be turned off. The other thing you could do is your encryption keys could be wrong. And the other thing you could have a problem with is that the signal is too weak. Your bedroom is just through too many of those brick walls. And you need to look at what you're going to do about that. Often a site survey utility can tell you the signal strength and whether you're actually going to get a signal in a particular location. One of the things you also have to keep in mind is that boosting the power on your wireless transmitter will not always solve the problem, because even if you boost the power on the access point, not all cards in laptops have the ability to boost the power on their wireless cards, so whilst you might be able to hear the access point might not be able to hear you, and that in itself is a problem. If you are intending on getting wireless signal to travel over a long distance, that's right, I was wondering where Elise was, and then I realised she's out to lunch for her birthday. So happy birthday, Elise, when you listen to this. When you get out to... If you are intending to throw a wireless signal over a longer distance, either get a better aerial, which can pick up more, or... Look at some sort of directional aerial. A lot of the time when you're trying to throw a wireless signal, you only need the signal to travel in a 180-degree arc rather than the 360-degree arc. And if you can cut off 180 degrees of the arc, that can also give you a lot more signal. But if you're going to throw it like 20, 30 kilometres, that's when you start looking at very directional beam and Yagi-type aerials. So that's sort of wireless and signal strength. Put devices on separate channels where possible. And this definitely matters if you've got multiple access points and you're going to hook them together into an ESS, or an extended service set, which we talked about last week, which is where you've got multiple access points hooked together with a distribution structure, i.e. Ethernet cabling or whatever. Put your different access points on different channels. Some client utilities will allow you to specify multiple SSIDs to roam to, although other ones you'll have to set them all to the same SSID, but put them on different channels so they don't clash with each other. Remembering, of course, that channels 1, 6, and 10 are non-overlapping. Actually, I think it's 1, 5, and 10. I'll have to check that. But they're the channels that don't overlap, 1, 5, and 10.
I think it's 1, 6, and 10, Kerry.
Yeah, although the thing that confuses me is if it's 1, 6, and 10, you've got 1, and you've got 2, 3, 4, 5, and you've got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I'd say it'd be 1, 6, and 11, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, no, because ours are set at 1 and 6. We don't have any problems.
No, I know 1 and 6 don't overlap. But what I'm saying is between 1 and 6, you've got...
I know what you're sort of getting at. It might be 11. I know it's 1 and 6 are the first two.
Yeah, no, it's 1 and 6. But between 1 and 6, you've got 4 channels. And then, obviously, 4 channels beyond channel 6 would be channel 11. So I think it's actually 1, 6 and 11, but I'd have to check that out. Also notice that the country that you've set your wireless card to work in can also often set the number of channels that you can use. If you set it to Australia, you can usually use between channels 1 and 13. If you set it to the US, you can use between 1 and 11. If you set it to Japan, sometimes you can either use 1 to 14 even, or you can only use 14. It depends on which particular version of Japan they've decided to implement. So the country that you've set your wireless card to can be important. Also, don't go putting access points up on channel 13, especially when your wife's laptop will only do from channels 1 to 11. Are you still with us, Gemma, or have you wandered off?
I'm back.
Ah, okay.
Trying to unblock my ear, but not having much success, so I'll just put up with my headphones and one good ear.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, you and cotton buds don't get on well.
Well, I've got stuff out with a cotton bud, but it's still blocked.
And you've done the hold your nose and blow trick?
No, I haven't tried that one.
Okay. If we hear this incredible bang come from Lockridge, we'll know you blew too hard.
Okay.
Okay, your SSID, back to the lecture, must match on all devices. If you have a hidden SSID, and I'm looking generally in a certain direction, which we won't worry too much about what direction that is, you actually need to know what that SSID is, otherwise you can't connect to your own network. Now, I'm not going to single this particular person out, but we did have an instance where they had a hidden SSID, and they didn't know what it was. Luckily, we found it hard-coded into one of the machines, and it's all good now. And we also know what the hidden SSID is. You can actually decloak those networks if you've already got machines that are talking to them, but you do need a copy of Kismet and a correctly set up computer with a wireless network card. So yes, if you're going to hide your SSID, make sure you know what it is. Otherwise, you won't be able to connect to it. Also, DHCP problems. Make sure you can talk to the DHCP server. Make sure the correct address has been assigned. Can anybody tell me the command that you use at the command prompt that works under Windows 2000 XP 2003 Server and Vista?
ipconfig/all.
Yes. Or if you're under Windows XP, you can actually go into, you hit enter on My Network Places and then hit enter on the network connection. And once you do that, you can then go to the support tab, which has all that information in it as well, which is often an easier way to read it off with speech software. And then if you're feeling really, really lazy, there's even a repair button you can press that might actually fix the problem. And if it fixes the problem, that's the end of it, but if it's not, then you've got to look harder at it. Okay, if devices cannot ping each other on an integrated router, check the security settings. Make sure you don't have Windows Firewall turned on. Or if you do have Windows Firewall turned on, make sure you've allowed ping. It's also worth noting that firewalls can be turned on for various interfaces. Now, if you've got a dual home configuration, which is a really networky way of saying multiple interfaces, it's only important that you enable the firewall on your network-facing interface, generally speaking. So if you've got one interface that's on the internet and one interface that's on the LAN, only enable the firewall on your internet interface if you would like to be able to do file sharing. Or configure the firewall so that it will allow file sharing and ping. And there is actually a way of configuring Windows Firewall so that it will allow SIFS file sharing to go through it. Okay, when you're checking whether you've got internet connectivity. Okay, well, the first time you'll know when you don't have internet activity is when you try to load a web page and it doesn't come up. Sorry about that, I was just sorting something out there. Let me see. Check the status screen of your router. Make sure you know where the status screen of your router is. Most people don't. Most routers have a web interface that can be accessed by going to http://, and the address it says in the book. You all read the book, didn't you? Yes, we've all read the book to our router from cover to cover.
A lot of those configurations are on whirlpool.net or .au or .com.au.
No, it's whirlpool.net.au because, as Mr. Legg aptly pointed out last week, if you go to .com.au, you get the washing machines.
Okay. Just to spin you around the opposite direction.
So I always thought Mr. Legg was a bit of an agitator. That said, I mean, I don't think they've got a network version of the Whirlpool washer yet.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I want to be able to tell that to my washing machine and type spin at the command prompt.
As long as you don't get a 169.254, you'll be right.
Yeah, exactly. So, what you have to do is you have to... I just remember what I was on about now. Oh, yeah. Read the book that comes with your router. I saw a question on VIPL the other day. This is just a little beef of mine. And it said, I would like to secure my wireless network. Okay, that's a very noble thing to do. How do I do it? Well, you know what? The book that comes with your router will tell you how to do it. It's all in there. And I actually wrote back to this person. I did give them an overview of the different securities, but I said, do read the book. I don't know what it is, but when you've got a computer, apparently help for your computer is 100% free, and whatever problem you should have, there should be somebody out there to help you. Ironically enough, you don't expect that sort of service with your Whirlpool washing machine. Exit soapbox, stage left.
And the manufacturer's websites have got a lot of good info as well.
Yeah, so we're talking washing machines or computers here, probably both.
Yeah, possibly, but mainly computers.
Yeah, exactly. Not that you would have experienced that phenomenon in retail at all, would you, Dean? People wanting their computer fixed for nothing?
Sick, yeah, right.
Yeah, so make sure you've read the book. Make sure you've read the documentation that comes with it. Go and have a look on the net. Last time I noticed, Google didn't bite. It's not a nasty... I mean, occasionally you can get malware served up by banner ads from various sites that you land on. I mean, obviously that is a risk, but, you know, you should have your spyware and antivirus stuff all set up. But do read the book that comes with your gear. There's even a troubleshooting section in the back that we usually resort to if things go wrong, and then it usually doesn't help us at all. But at least we resorted to it so that when we do call the support department up, we go, oh, yeah, we went through all that. And it will tell you how to secure things. With all the documents turning up in PDF these days, a lot of them are accessible. And in fact, some of the really good routers you get, the documents actually come in HTML, and that's even better. I've noticed the Atheros client utility for the Asus EEE PCs is actually HTML pages, and they show up in Internet Explorer or your default browser of choice.
The ones for the DreyTech do as well.
Yeah, they're not bad. Do you know if the DreyTech has a command line interface, or is it just web-based?
You can tell that into it. I haven't got the CLI commands for it yet.
Fair enough, because Aaron didn't think they had a CLI, and I thought they may have, given the price of them.
No, it's as far as I can understand, they do. I know I've just got to... did I download them the other day?
That's all right, I'm sure you'll find it if you
can. I'll let you know if I do.
Yeah, no worries. Also, the Netcom routers you can SSH into, which is kind of cool. And you'll find out what SSH and stuff is later on in this course. Okay, so you're checking whether you've got internet connectivity. We're back to that. Make sure your username and password are correct. That's a good one. And if it doesn't authenticate when you sort of put those in, hit retry, and then if it doesn't authenticate again, make sure you retype them. The usual stuff. Also, in pure IT crowd style, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again? That's also another good way of fixing a lot of problems. We're still talking about computers here, not washing machines. And then, after you've done all this, you then check with the ISP to see if they're having a problem. Funnily enough, people at the help desk get a little bit irate, and they have to do it off the phone because they'd never do that while they're on the phone to you, when you ring up and you go through all this troubleshooting stuff with them, and then they find out that the power pack for your router fell out of the power board. Okay, any questions on that? That all seems pretty straightforward to me. Okay, now we're on to help desk issues. Good documentation is important. Doesn't matter how many times we say it, people still aren't going to do it. But we'll say it anyway. Good documentation is important. Nobody is indispensable. When you get fired, the next bloke who takes over your job might need to know what you did. Unless you're sort of the vindictive sort of person that doesn't want anybody to know what you did, and you make this spaghetti mess, and then you get fired, and then they have to go and pay somebody even more money to work out what you did. But that said, good documentation is important. It's also important for troubleshooting things. If you had a problem, and you've documented, and the same problem comes up again, you can refer to your documentation and fix the problem even quicker. A lot of people will come up with a counter-argument as to, well, who's got time to write documentation? That's certainly one I've used in the past. That's when you convince people to pay you extra money to write documentation, so that's always useful. Good documentation. And it can also help the help desk people if they're trying to help you with something. If you have good network maps, network diagrams, and you've got the physical and logical flow of data so that they can tell what connects to what connects to what connects to what. It also means that, and we'll cover this later on in the module, you certainly want to be putting interface descriptions on your interfaces, and the interface descriptions should be readable and understandable by more than just you. So a description that says S2 to S1/3 isn't going to mean anything, but if you say link to SANDOSA, that can mean more than just giving a couple of interface identifiers in the interface description. Alrighty. Document the baseline performance. How do you expect this thing to perform normally? Now, this is an interesting one because often people ring up the internet service provider, as you do, and they sit on hold for about half an hour, and they finally get through to the harrowed level one support technician, who's having a really good day, and they say, "My internet's running slow." And then the guy goes, "Oh, well, define slow. What do you mean by slow?" "Oh, it's just really slow." Now, that's really unhelpful. What is really slow? What is normal? And how slow is really slow? So have an idea of the download speeds and things you should be getting on your connection, and then compare them to what you're getting now. If you're only getting, for example, we usually get 54, 55k a second. If you're only getting, say, 10 or 15k a second, and the site is a well-connected one, you may have a problem. Obviously, if it's downloading from some tent in Uzbekistan over a 33.6 modem, you're not going to get the full 55k a second, so be aware of that. Also, if you're downloading from an extremely busy site, you may not always see full bandwidth. But be aware of what the baseline performance should be and how it should behave, so that when you tell somebody what how slow it is, I should have had two cups of coffee this morning, you can then give them some idea of what the difference between normal and slow is. Document your problems and solutions. That way, you can look back on your documents and go, "Oh yes, seen this one. Okay, we know how to fix that." Use outsources. Use outside sources. Your friends, your instructors, provided they're not at home on the weekend. Your networking colleagues, your workmates, and whoever else you can ask, the kid up the road. That's usually a good resource, the kid up the road. Usually the kid up the road knows more than you do about computers, just by definition. Although, your computer may not be in the same state as you would like it to be once the kid up the road has finished with it. So make sure the people you use are trustworthy and are reliable and good technicians. And that can be a problem as well, finding good and reliable technicians. Also look online, looking at online frequently asked questions, documents, knowledge bases. How good are knowledge bases? There are people who do they survive their entire IT career by searching the Microsoft knowledge base. Has anybody here ever been to the Microsoft knowledge base? I know I have, and I think Gemma has.
Oh yeah, no, regularly. And the that Oz Cable guy is another good website for information.
Yeah, it is actually. Often when Windows shows up an error that you've never seen before, cutting and pasting the error into the Microsoft Knowledge Base search box will often get you the answer to your problem, or a couple of support articles that deal with the problem and can tell you where the problem is coming from. And that is a really big one. You can really solve a lot of problems by doing that. Also, the Microsoft Knowledge Base has an incredible amount of documentation on various things. They've basically been keeping this thing running since about 1994, 1995, and just as new things come out, it just gets added into the Knowledge Base, and the wealth of information is in there is insanely good. For example, I didn't realise that there's actually quite a nifty and high-powered command line partitioning tool under Windows XP 2003 Server and Vista called DiskPart. And if you search for DiskPart, D-I-S-K-P-A-R-T, you will find documentation on how to use it in the Microsoft Knowledge Base. So there you go. The other one to find documentation on is a thing called NetSH, which is a utility that can dump and restore and change your network configurations from the command line. And that's another good one to know about. The other handy-dandy utility that can do all sorts of things to your Windows system is a thing called PowerShell. But that's not really networky related, so we won't go into that. But you can do all sorts of policy things and Active Directory things, and it's got a little programming language in it and stuff. And it's Microsoft's scripting answer to the Linux shell scripting ability. Okay, back to help desks. Provide all necessary information to the help desk. Don't tell a story, unless the story is relevant. The help desk doesn't want to know how many mates you had over and how many tinnies you sunk before you went and, like, played a couple of games of pool, and then you turned the computer on, and then Jim said that this was happening, and then this was happening, and then we found out the internet wasn't working. Cut to the chase. Storytellers are tedious. I've worked on a help desk, and I don't want to hear the story. It might be a good story. It might have more Australian yarns in it than the average bush picnic, but we'd like to know what the problem is. So unless the story is relevant, skip it. However, if the story is relevant, be ready to tell it, because you might be asked what you were doing when this problem particularly happened. But there is a fine line between giving too much information and not giving enough. Keep your own log of calls to the help desk and the various solutions and problem resolutions they asked you to try. This means that if you get cranky with the help desk and need to lodge a complaint, you can match your call records with their call records and can say that I called on this day, and this day, and still nothing happened. Also, if possible, take the name or ID of the technician who helped you. Often,
oh, yeah, no, they do that all the time.
Well, that's what I'm saying, if possible. Sometimes they will absolutely point blank refuse to give it to you, and that's when you lodge a complaint. But always take the name of the person who told you stuff and note that down somewhere, and then that way you can ring back and go, well, technician 47 told me that I should do this, or Bob told me I should do that, or Jan told me I should do that, or whatever, whoever it happens to be. That said, any advice we provide as Cisco instructors is given with absolutely no warranty, either expressed or implied, and if we tell you to do something and your computer blows up, we're very sorry, but there you go. So, just so you know, we don't back our information with any type of guarantees whatsoever, although it usually works for us, but it might not work for you. And the same goes for the mailing lists. So, there you have it. And you can take our name down as many times as you like, but it probably won't make much difference. And that's the end of that module. That's the end of the bridging work, and we now get to move on to Discovery Lecture 1. Discovery 2, Lecture 1, even. Okay. Any questions before we move on to Discovery Lecture 2, Module 1? And we'll just leave the recording running, because it's all going to be as one recording, you think, so. Or any comments? Am I the only one that feels nostalgic by the fact that F10 will also pull up the menu bar, as well as the Alt key? There's a throwback to X3 Gold, if ever I saw one.
Yeah, that was a good program.
By accident.
I know people who still try and use X3 Gold under Windows XP.
That's sad. So
it's a crock. It's not designed to run under XP.
No, I used to run it under when it was a DOS base. It was great.
Yeah, because they had X3, and then they had X3 Gold, and then they had X3 Pro. X3 Pro and then X3 Gold. And you still get people who try and run X3 under Windows. And depending on the versions of X3 that you run, it either doesn't handle large drives properly, it doesn't show you the right amount of disk space, or it munges all of your long file names.
Why bother?
Some people have old habits that die hard, I think. Although that said, there are some good file managers for Windows. In fact, Jamal Mizrui wrote a really speech-friendly one called Filder, which is on www.theempowermentzone.com. And it's actually quite a good file manager, and it works fairly well. And I don't know how I got onto file managers. Let's go on. Oh, that's right, I was talking about F10 and the menu keys. Okay. Discovery Lecture 1, the Internet and its uses. Okay. Does anybody not know what the Internet is by this time in the course? Because if you don't know what the Internet is, I'm really thinking of just giving you a straight fail here and now. Anybody not know what the Internet is? Anyone who doesn't answer gets an instant fail.
I just expected an answer.
Somebody want to tell me what the Internet is?
It's a group of networks that are all joined together sharing information.
Yeah, Glenn likes your answer. He was halfway through telling an answer and then you gave one. I would go as far as saying it is a worldwide network of networks that all share information together. No. She wanted to know whether that was a fail for you, Dean, but I think we'll let you pass today.
Oh, okay. I haven't come across this point of presence and exchange point thing before, which is unusual. It's...
Steady on. We're getting down to that. We're not down there yet. We'll be doing that bit. I've got to start at the beginning. Okay, the internet is a network of networks that we all use to share information. And it was originally developed by people who wanted to make a network that would withstand a nuclear attack, yada, yada, yada. We did this last module, initially designed to withstand a nuclear attack, and it was like in the early 60s, and it was by the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project, I think. Yeah, that's right. And then the universities all got on board with it, and it all was very big in universities, and you had email, and you had FTP, and all that sort of stuff. Can anybody tell me when the World Wide Web first started becoming popular? When did it first... Like, when could you actually go on the World Wide Web?
Early 90s.
Yeah. And want to be a little more accurate, or have a guess?
Was it 1992?
It was actually the end of 93, early 94. Tim Berners-Lee first put the first couple of websites up. One of the first websites that went up was a thing called the CERN, at the CERN Institute. There was a web, World Wide Web site, and it had new sites of the day. And every day or so, you'd get three or four new websites you could go and visit. I think it'd be pretty safe to say that the world has changed a bit since then. There's a few more websites than two or three new per day that you go to one site and you can look up. And in fact, the internet is integral to many, many, many business operations and procedures and stuff. And an interesting case in point is that it's actually quite a nasty way of being attacked by terrorists. If you get some terrorists that take down significant parts of the internet infrastructure, you can do some quite nasty damages to a large percentage of businesses. And in fact, the FBI, and they're always making sort of statements about things, because that's what they do pretty well, are saying that cyber terrorism is going to be a significant threat in the years to come. And that's not in your notes. I just thought I'd throw that in for something interesting. Okay. The internet is anarchistic in nature. A lot of it is not controlled by one particular person. It's controlled by a whole lot of people cooperating and stuff. Which means you've got to be careful, because some of the stuff is really good and some of the stuff is not so good. Also, there are companies that have monopolies over certain sections of the internet. For example, there are only a number of tier 1 providers that actually bring bandwidth into Australia. And if you don't go along with their rules and pay their prices, you don't get internet access. So, interesting. There are sort of monopolistic, is the word I want, sections of the internet, and then there are stuff that is controlled by various people. Now, the internet was opened up to commercial and business interests in 1991. Before that, it was for scientific and research use only. That said, there was certainly a lot of news groups where you could buy and sell things and read stories and stuff. So obviously scientific and research had quite a broad scope. But yes, they opened it up to the commercial arm of things, and it became the case of... and I think 1995-96 was when dial-up users at home and stuff really started getting on the internet. Not many people I know had internet access before 1996. Did anybody here have internet access before 1996? I did.
Why does that surprise me?
I did.
Yeah, Glenn did, but not from home. Yeah, I was actually with APANA, an Australian Public Access Network Association, in May 1993. And I used to do UUCP mail runs between Sydney and Tamworth, and I would pull in email and Usenet news, which is what you did back in those days. I also had access to an APANA system in late 92. But it really started picking up, like the Microplex, as it was known by them, they got bought out by OptusNet, and it was never quite the same after that. It started putting in what we call points of presence, which I'll get to in a minute, in various regional areas and stuff back in 1995-96. But yeah, often you could get access through schools and universities prior to 1995, but dial-up access was somewhat thin on the ground. You could get it, but it wasn't the average run-of-the-mill thing. Okay, but how does everything interoperate with each other on the internet, and how does it do it in a good way? The answer to that is you've got internet standards. You've got the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, and you have RFCS, which are requests, RFCs even, which are requests for comments. And all of these standards go through this discussion and voting and talking and discussion and stuff, and then they get formalised. They go from a standards draft through to a request for comments. And you can find those RFCs by looking on the net. I usually get a lot of them from www.rfc-editor.org, but there are certainly other places where you can get them. And there's about 3,000 or 4,000 of them by now, standardising all different things. SMTP, DNS, all the different protocols for the internet, packet formats, IPv6, and you can go and look up those RFCs if you really want to know how something works. They're pretty droll reading, but they will tell you specifically how a standard should be implemented. Then you can go and check up all of the news groups and forums and stuff and find out where Microsoft, or insert your favourite vendor here, has violated the RFCs and caused grief for everybody. It's not just Microsoft that does it. A lot of the vendors do put extensions in that aren't RFC compatible, and that can certainly cause some grief. Okay, an internet service provider. I think we all know what they are. They provide internet services either to a business, or home users, or other ISPs. So you can have big ISPs providing service to the little ISPs, so it's a bit like the ISP food chain. And you can get services such as mail, web, FTP, VoIP, web hosting, media streaming, which brings up an interesting point. A lot of people who don't know any better are under the misimpression that if the mail is stored on your ISP server, it's their responsibility to look after it for you. And one of the ISPs I worked at, we actually had a user who had about 2,000 messages in their inbox. And they'd click the Keep Mail on Server button because they obviously read it with POP from multiple machines. And then when their inbox file got corrupted and they lost all of their messages, they got really cranky with it and said, well, you should have been backing it up. I said, oh, yeah, we did, but your mailbox got corrupted. And that's the end of it. You should have the mail on your own system. Yeah, sorry. So it's very important that you understand where the levels of responsibility and stuff beginning and end. The other thing is, whilst you may get viruses off the internet through your ISP, for example through web surfing and stuff, unless the virus is actually hosted on the ISP's web servers, which can be the case at various times, it's not up to the ISP to ensure that you have antivirus and anti-spyware stuff on your computer. It is actually up to you. Which is interesting, because I noticed the ANZ Bank, for example, are actually giving you a discount on some antivirus software so that you can actually protect yourself from possible phishing things and fraud stuff on the internet, and you can actually buy it through the bank website and get a discount on it, which I thought was kind of cool. Okay, so That's basically your ISP, and we'll talk a bit more about those in a moment. Stuff you're likely to find at an ISP. Well, you're going to find up, you'll often find DSL AMs, or a DSL access multiplexer, which is where you pull all of your DSL lines in. Although a lot of the time the DSL AMs are actually in the Telstra exchanges, and then the Telstra exchanges hand the authentication off to the ISP server, and the authentication uses a protocol called RADIUS, Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service, which is kind of a funky acronym if you're into those sorts of things, and that's what authenticates you with the ISP or not. You've also got cable termination units if you're using cable internet, which was sort of very good if you've got cable running along your street and completely useless otherwise. And then you've got things like fibre optic and wireless and satellite, so you can have a wireless queue at the ISP. Okay, bandwidth is measured in bits per second, or megabits per second, or kilobits per second, or gigabits per second. And if you would like to revise bandwidth, I will refer you back to CCNA 1, Module 2, because we go back through it in there. I'm going to assume you all know how to calculate how long it's going to take to send a 10 meg file over a 56 kilobit per second link. And if you don't, then that's somewhat of a concern. I'd suggest you go back over your notes. If we really do need to revise it, we will. But we do expect that is assumed knowledge by now. Okay, you've got your different sorts of lines. You've got a T1 line, which is 1.54 megabits per second, symmetric. In other words, the upload speed is the same as the download. Or you've got the E1, which is 2.048 megabits per second, which is the European standard. In Australia, we have the European standard. A T3, which is often used for big businesses, is 45 megabits per second. Although an E3 is 34.6 megabits per second, and I'm not sure why that is. I'll have to look that up, but it's to do with the clock rates of the various signals. Any questions so far?
What's generally used at a university?
Depends how much money the IT department at the university's got.
Like sort of Kurt as an example.
I think they might have a... I think they've got 50 or 100 megabits coming in. That's quite a bit for Curtin. So usually looking at 50, 100 megabits, depending on the university. And of course, how efficiently you use that bandwidth is going to make sure that various things behave in different ways. For example, here we've got 2 megabits symmetric, which is kind of cool. So we try to use that as efficiently as possible. We've got proxy servers and things to make sure that things run fairly smoothly. But, depending on the university, anywhere between 2 and 100 megabits, maybe more. It depends on how the internet access is provided. In Australia, for example, you do have volume charging and you do have volume limits and volume caps. So you don't have the situation in the US where you can pull hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes of traffic and nobody will notice. So that does sort of constrain things a bit in Australia. Okay, now we talk about points of presence, or POPs. A point of presence is a place where the internet service provider has got some of their stuff. Either it's got the DSLAMs for ADSL dial-ins, although generally that's housed in the phone exchanges, or it's got the dial-in modem racks, or it's got the communications equipment for fibre, T1s, E1s, E3s, etc. The points of presence all connect together, and they can actually connect to the network access point, which is how the ISP can connect to other ISPs and various businesses and things. Usually the backbones of the big ISPs and stuff, and we're talking about the Tier 3 stuff here, tends to be connected with fibre. And some of the cables that run under the ocean are copper cables, and they're still encased in the plastic and stuff that protects them, and sometimes they're fibre. Obviously, there's a lot more bandwidth that can go over fibre than there can over copper. Now, what they will often do when they lay fibre, because it's such a pain to lay fibre, is they will often lay bundles of 10, 50, or 100 fibres, and they'll have a lot of them dark. In other words, they won't actually have stuff on them, and then when they want more capacity, they will light up more of the fibres and run signals down through them. Okay, you've got your Tier 2 service providers, which buy services off your Tier 1 providers, and then you've got your Tier 3, which are the stuff that usually provides access to cities and stuff like that. So, for example, Telstra and Optus in Australia are considered Tier 1 service providers. Okay, we're revising. Any questions before I move on past that stuff?
So the DSLAMs, are they owned by the network, the ISP, or are they owned by Telstra?
Both. That is to say that Telstra has a DSLAM network, and IINet has a DSLIM network. A DSLAM network, and depending on which network you are on, whether your exchange is enabled or not, will depend on which DSLAM you get connected to.
Doesn't OptusNet now have this DSLAM with their own exchanges?
They do, and you can actually sometimes get onto the Optus DSLAMs on the Optus exchanges, but I'm not sure as to what speed their DSLAMs are. I know Amcom has a set of DSLAMs, IINet has them, I think Westnet still goes through Telstra, as does TPG. It just depends on the company. But sometimes it can mean the difference between getting ADSL 2 and ADSL 2 Plus. Internode has their own DSLAMs as well. But yeah, it depends on whether you've got those DSLAMs in your exchange as to whether you can actually connect to them, and that will often govern the speed of internet access you are able to get. And often it can make a big difference as to how cheap or expensive the plans are. Because if you're using Telstra's DSLAMs, you've got to pay Telstra a certain rental cost to use that each month, and the ISP passes that cost on to you. Any other questions? Okay, and now we're revising ping and traceroute. Now, is everybody happy with ping and traceroute, or do we want to go over it again?
No. Oh, some people might need it.
Alright, ping sends echo request packets and looks for echo reply packets. You are given the round trip time of the echo request and echo reply packets. You can execute ping from most operating systems that contain a TCP/IP stack, Cisco command line interfaces, and Windows command prompts, and Linux command prompts being some of the more notable examples. Also, some routers have a web-based version of the ping thing you can execute. Traceroute will show you the path from source to destination of two network devices, and that depends on how much of the ICMP traffic is being blocked as to whether that traceroute will work or not. Some network address translating routers will allow traceroute through and some of them won't. And some of them will allow ping through and some of them won't, although the ones that don't allow ping through are pretty crummy. Traceroute sends a packet to an unconnected UDP port, and it decrements the TTL each time it sends the packet out. The TTL is the time to live on a packet, and it looks for ICMP time exceeded messages to come back from a various destination. So what you basically do is you send out a packet with a TTL of 1. It travels through the first router, and it then gives you an ICMP time exceeded message, and you can then find out where the first router was based on that time exceeded message. And then you keep incrementing your TTL and sending your packets out further and further from the destination, from the source to the destination, until you reach the destination. And that is how Traceroute works, and there are various labs that you do that demonstrate that. And the Windows version of Traceroute is called TraceRT.
And you can forward it to a text file for if you need it for documentation or whatever.
Yes, you can go traceRT space the host or the IP address, and then you can go space greater than outfile.txt, and then you can cut and paste relevant bits of that into your lab work. Okay, one of the things that I've got to mention here is that as well as the other equipment at the ISPs, you've got your DSLAMs. You've got your cable termination units, you've got your web servers, your FTP servers, your media streaming servers, all that sort of thing. You also have border routers, which connect the ISPs to other businesses and other ISPs and the internet at large. And you also have, you'd hope that you have some power backup, so that if the main power grid goes a bit whoopsie, you've got a little bit of a buffer zone so that you can stay up and running for a while. And in fact, some very big Tier 1 ISPs actually have generators and things to keep things running when the power grids go down for a certain amount of time. Then you've got the other ISPs that just go down in a heap. Before the days of journaled file systems, if you lost power on your server, it could be for half an hour to 45 minutes for the file system checks to complete. And during that half an hour to 45 minutes, you wouldn't be able to get any users to log in, and that would make them quite cranky indeed. An ISP should be scalable. As the number of users increase on the network should be able to increase in size. Otherwise, once your internet starts becoming slow and unreliable, your customers will often jump ship and go to a competing ISP. Okay, you've got many roles of ISPs. You've got your network support services, which are the people who keep the network up and running and keep it all together and happening. You've got customer service. Well, you might have customer service. In theory, you've got customer service, although in my experience, a lot of ISPs don't have any customer service whatsoever. But you'd hope they have customer service, and some of them have excellent customer service. And often, the ISP you go with can often be decided by their level of customer service. And sometimes a surprise. Okay, you've got the planning and provisioning staff, and they're the ones that can decide whether network equipments can go in certain locations and how it's going to happen. And they're also the mob that decide whether you can have ADSL or not on your phone line. That's the provisioning mob that talk to Telstra's provisioning mob and do all that sort of thing. You have the on-site installation staff, which are people who are actually responsible for setting up the equipment. A lot of ISPs encourage self-install, which means you set the equipment up and you set it up because it's a lot cheaper. A lot of people don't feel like paying $300 for a technician to come out to their house and do the install work. The Network Operations Centre are the mob that's making sure that the connection's all ready to go, and they do all the testing and make sure the connection is ready to go live. And then you've got the people at the help desk who then ring users up and provide them with the usernames, passwords and various connection settings to assist them in connecting to the internet. The end. Any questions? And silence is golden, but my eyes don't see. Okay.
Oh, and there's three levels of the help desk.
I think that actually depends on the help desk layout, but I think... where did you say there were three layers? I saw there were... I've seen multiple layers mentioned in the notes, but I didn't think it said three.
It mentioned it somewhere in the notes, but depends on the service provider. Some of them have only got one. Some have several.
Yeah, that's certainly worth mentioning. I mean, there are multiple levels of help desk, and you often get level one help desk, and then if your problem is too confusing for level one help desk, you can often get escalated to level two or up various levels of help desk, and often the people who are higher up the help desk chain have tools that are not accessible to the lower levels of the help desk mob.
Or if it's engine, you end up knowing more than what their first level does.
I usually end up knowing more than their third level a lot of the time, but that's just depends on who you talk to. I rang up Netgear, because I had some flaky switches. And I rang up to do a problem report, and the guy's like, well, have you tried this, and you tried that, and did you try connecting one PC into it, and did you look at all the lights? And I sort of said, mate, I am CCNA certified. Yes. And he's like, oh, I see. And I sort of said, well, look, you know, I respect that you have to ask me these questions, but yeah, I've tried a few of these things. Because I said, no offence to you, I said, I'd rather be trying these things myself than talking to you. No, we don't believe the devices work as advertised.
No, I was rather disappointed with Engine's first level help desk support. The knowledge was very poor in some cases.
Yeah, look, the first level help desk is only designed for, well, have you tried turning it on and off again? And did you make sure that you plugged this, you know, peg A into hole B sort of stuff? But sometimes it can be quite a battle to get past the first level and up to the second level to actually get your problem resolved if it doesn't fit within the first level scope of the problem resolution.
Yeah, it makes a difference, though, if you're knowing what the problem resolution is and they're not listening to you.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a problem, too. Although, as a help desk person, you do have to ascertain whether the user's problem resolution is correct, and depending on your ability, that can be somewhat of a challenge. The ability of the help desk person, not the user, is what I'm talking about here. Sometimes they can't ascertain whether your resolution is correct or not.
But a lot of the times they're only basing their questions and answers off a set questions and answers that they have in front of them anyway.
Yes, a lot of level one help desk is scripted. And if you're using equipment that they're not familiar with, or you've done something that they're not familiar with, or you know something that's not on their script, that can certainly be a problem. I remember getting into an argument with TPG Tech Support at one point, sort of saying, and they're like, well, have you got the green router or the red router? And I'm like, well, I don't have your router. And they're like, well, we can't help you then. I said, yes, you can. I said, your terminal server isn't allocating me an address. And I said, it's as simple as that. I'm looking at the LCP dump of the PPP session, and you're not allocating me an address. And I finally managed to get through to this guy that, no, they weren't allocating me an address, and could they please check, get somebody in second-level tech support to check the IP address allocation and find out what was going on. And funnily enough, 5 minutes later, the problem was resolved. But I think we've all got our funky help desk stories that we could tell. Alrighty. Anybody else got anything else they'd like to discuss, ask questions on before we leave it for today? Because next week will be Module 2, and we're still working on getting the labs transitioned across for Discovery 2. That should be happening fairly soon, and I think we're setting up the racks and things on Wednesday. We'll be having more bundles. So there you go, Dean, there'll be more bundles for you to Telnet to.
What equipment are they having in the bundles?
There'll be two switches, two routers, and workstations on much faster machines, virtual workstations. And I think we are also looking at setting up bundles that contain Linksys WRT 300N routers and some workstations.
Oh, okay, that's really good. Give me something else to attack.
Exactly. And no, you don't get to keep the stuff if you break it.
Yeah, because you've got the... Are they using the CLI commands to access the Linksys routers or not?
No, there are no CLI commands to access the Linksys routers unless you flash alternate firmware. And I've been told I'm not allowed to, so we're going to have to set up some open VPN access, which is www.openvpn.net, if anybody's interested in having a look, so that you can actually get in and connect to the web interfaces of these routers.
Yeah, that's right. I've got a lot of the documentation on that for those types of routers, which is helpful also if anybody wants it.
Yeah, we'll look at converting out the 300N manual and stuff and putting it up on the site as well for people who might want to read through it. So that's certainly something that we can do. All right, well, I think we'll stop recording.